afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Suderstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addis, to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Thursday, May 18th, 2017. Good afternoon, Al.
Hi, Melody.
As we were talking prior to the program, it's a hot one here on the east coast of Maryland, and I'm sure it is in Texas, too. A lot of storms I
see.
It's
not that hot. Not that hot today. It's not bad. It's warm, but it's not really that hot.
Well, this is probably our warmest day of the year so far, and it's a good one. And a lot of major storms going into up the central part of our country. A lot of tornadoes, a lot of outbreaks, and property damage, and of course the loss of lives. So, you know, that's the bad part about you know, this time of the year with those tornadoes. And when I lived in Missouri, you know, it's you know, half the people don't even take the warnings seriously, and the other half are, you know, but
paranoid.
But I'll tell you what, we were in one where we were out in the country, and the sheriff is driving down the road with his little microphone and saying, "Tornado, tornado, take cover immediately, take cover immediately." And that does kind of get yourself talking to yourself, but you know, it's like, well, where do you go? So anyway, be safe out there, folks.
Go hide in the mobile home.
Well, you know, it's you know, any little home out in the middle of nowhere certainly can get damaged and so forth. And there's not a lot of choices. Trees, you don't want to be around trees. And but those who live in that area and get these warnings all the time, they know what precautions to take. So just be safe out there, folks. And there was a wild situation in New York today at Times Square. Driver, the last report I heard is he was intoxicated. He had several previous DUIs and so forth. And he was actually going up the wrong way, and he went quite a ways. And fortunately, he drove up on the sidewalk. I know there was one person that was killed and about 13 or 14 others injured and so forth. So a lot of people there. So it's unfortunate that one person was killed, but it certainly could have been a lot worse. Well, speaking of things getting whacked today, they did it to gold, although gold did pretty good considering, you know, yesterday's, I don't even know what you want to call it, you know, the buildup to the investigation of Donald Trump and the Russian connection, and the appointment of Mueller, you know, with the market Dow dropping almost 400 points. And, of course, by the end of the New York spot closing last night, it was up about $24. Gold really didn't do so bad today. It's down. It's down $12.50, so it came, you know, it lost half of its gain yesterday. So that's really pretty good considering some of these other markets. So you have gold at $12.49.40, down $12.50. Silver down 26 cents at $16.70. Platinum was down 14 at $935. Palladium was down 20 at $765. The USDX today came back some. It was up 0.50. at 97.92, with crude oil, it was also up 25 at 49.32. Paper markets today, there was one announcement today. We'll touch on that here right after we get into, Trump gave a formal notice today that he's going to renegotiate NAFTA. And that came out about 2:15. And even though the markets were up and down all day long, early morning trade, they were down 100 points. They came back. They you know, they were all over the place today. And the market came around, was shot up over 100 points, and it looks like it's now settling at 56 points to the upside, 20,663. The NASDAQ up 43 points at 6,055, and the S&P was up 8 at 2,365. Yes, the euro is pressure, 111, 10-year yield, 2.23%. Actually, the European markets, they too came back. Early morning trade, you know, I'm talking about 4 or 5 o'clock this morning, you know, they were all down over 1%. They were still down, but they did regain some of those losses. They turned around. So, but still down, with London down almost a full percentage point. So it was about 2:15 today when this announcement I saw, and the markets shot upward. But Trump gave a formal notice about NAFTA to renegotiate. Negotiations can begin at the earliest in August. The administration sent a letter to Congress that triggers a 90-day consultation period among the administration, Congress, and business. I don't know why you have to have 90 days to consult. You know, I mean, it's like, oh, well, they don't have anything else to do. But hey, they go on vacation pretty soon. So really, do they really need 90 days? Or maybe that's why they did it now, knowing that everyone's going to be gone. And, oh, it's just silly. But anyway, so the negotiations can begin at the earliest in August. Mexican officials welcomed the Trump administration's announcement, but their tone on NAFTA was a little different. The trilateral agreement has been an immense benefit for all parties, Mexico's economic ministry said. Mexico reaffirms its willingness to update NAFTA, but they also said that you don't give us tariffs either, because if you give us tariffs, we're going to give you tariffs back. So we'll all see how that works out.
And what if they give us illegal aliens? Do we get to give them illegal aliens in return?
Yeah, perhaps.
Okay.
Trump officials haven't yet been specific about what they want to change in the deal. And this is what irritates me, you know. It's just like it's everything, every program that they've done. They don't have the specifics. It's like oh, you know, that'll come later. You don't need to know anything. And that's what bothers me. We've seen it with healthcare. We've seen it with the tax reform. We've seen it with the infrastructure. We even saw it when we talked about the new NATO, quote unquote, NATO program with Saudi Arabia. Well, this is what we want to do, but nothing is, you know, we really don't know what we want to do, but this is kind of what we want to do. And it's just like.
That might be kind of Trump's strategy under the art of the deal.
Perhaps, but
I mean, there's no point if you're going to negotiate with someone. There's probably not good reason to go out and tell them in advance, listen, we're going to sit down and negotiate this next week, but here's everything we want.
Well, I'm not suggesting.
Well, that might be just his mindset on this thing. You keep it mysterious, and then you can kind of spring things on your adversaries, and perhaps you can get them to agree with, you know, surprise them, and maybe they go along with the program. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just speculating that maybe Trump is doesn't want to show his hand before he negotiates.
I agree. Leverage is everything when you're trying to negotiate, but yet you would still think there'd be, something that they'd want to, you know, target in on an industry or something. I don't know. But anyway, they did have to wait. There was a major hurdle that was cleared last week when Trump had his top negotiator, Robert, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Lighthizer, I guess. He is the top negotiator. He was confirmed last week.
Negotiating. He's there to negotiate the NAFTA treaty.
That's correct. That's correct. We already know that there was a 20% tariff on Canadian lumber in April, and again, the warning comes from Mexico not to mess with tariffs. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told lawmakers also today that he has some doubts, really, what are known as alternative scoring models. That will give enough credit to the potential for economic growth when assessing the impact of the Trump administration's tax plan. So, and the administration put out a one-page overview of the tax reform plan, which everyone knows would cut taxes for businesses to 15%, as well as cutting taxes and supposedly simplifying income tax brackets for individuals. But the big question is, how are the tax cuts, how would they be offset without driving up the federal deficit? And Mnuchin told the Senate Banking Committee today, he has repeatedly said that any plan we put forward, we believe should be paid for with economic growth. Yeah, I mean, That's a given.
And if it doesn't grow, then what will it pay for?
Yeah. How are you going to get it to grow? And he says, I am concerned as to whether some of the models will attribute enough growth in dynamic scoring. So he's concerned that there's not going to be enough rigging done, enough lying about the growth to and adjusting the numbers to give them the plan that they want, that they've...
Well, what the dynamic scoring, what I understand, is that the dynamic scoring means that you can pick from a host of economic models, and some of them predict that the economy will grow by 3%, and some predict that it'll grow by 1%, and some predict it'll grow by no percent or zero or negative percentage. It'll actually decline, and there are apparently a couple dozen of these models that you can pick from, and they call it, what is this, dynamic scoring?
Yeah, but the dynamic
It's all fantasy stuff. It's saying, look, I'm going to sell you a new house, and you're going to be able to, you buy this house from me, and you'll be able to sell it next year for five times what you paid for it. Well, if you don't, too bad for you. But dynamic scoring means, well, we've got another five times is ridiculous, but we're going to get you two times, or maybe three times. This is just cooking the books. That's
exactly
all this is. Dynamic scoring is code for cooking the books.
It's lying. You can adjust any number you want. Mm-hmm. If someone said to me, Melody, show me where gold went up 1,000%, I could go back and I could do enough research and come out and come up with a model that will show you exactly what you want to see.
Yep.
I mean, you can adjust the numbers. All these charts, that's why I don't believe in charts. You know, when you had real markets and free markets, charts mattered because it did show the trend. But today in a manipulated market, in a rigged market, you may as well just throw those charts away because they don't mean anything. And this is the same thing. These models, well, he's concerned that they're not going to choose the model that's going to attribute enough growth. I mean, it's really kind of... Anyway, Mnuchin has said the April plan was deliberately vague in order to allow the White House to more effectively work with lawmakers to come up with a joint agreement that could pass Congress. So, yeah, we don't want anybody to know about it. You know, so we need to get it passed. And I don't know, Al, if you feel it's the same thing as the, you know, leverage for when you're trying to negotiate. But I don't think they really have a plan. And that's why it was deliberately vague, but
well,
anyway.
I think there's another point to it too. If you tell people exactly what you're looking for, like I said, it gives them a better opportunity to defeat you. If you're telling them, look, I want $100, they already know, okay, we can get him for 50.
Yeah, but you,
right? They can cut that. If you come in, you don't, they don't know how much you're looking for, they don't know, then they don't know how much, they don't exactly know how much they're willing to settle for.
Yeah, but you know what, Al, if this was a good plan, I don't believe that there should be negotiations with lawmakers just to pass something. If it's good and it's good for the citizens of this country, why do you have to negotiate?
Because maybe it's not good for the congressman, Melody. Do you think about that? I mean, they're in here too, and they need to negotiate something. I mean, they need a tip from time to time, a little gratuity.
So there shouldn't, my point,
show your appreciation.
There shouldn't be negotiations, you know.
Are, though. It's the nature. It's been that way since time began, and it isn't going to end anytime soon. It's supposed to be the nature of the legislators, the legislative branch. They are supposed to sit down, and I have an idea for a law, and somebody else has an idea, and we sit down, kick it around one way or another, and eventually we get to a point in theory where we get something that the majority of the people in the legislature are willing to go along with. And if we can, you know, something that it doesn't suit anybody perfectly, probably, but the two sides are willing to compromise in order to get something done, and it's half
in
favor of one side, half in favor of the other side, another half in favor of another side. Everybody's in it to see what they can get out of it.
Yeah. Their districts. Yeah.
And it maybe for not even for the district exactly, but for themselves.
Yeah.
All right. And I don't just mean in terms of money, but can they take credit? This, oh, I did this. I helped negotiate this. I don't know.
Well, Mnuchin,
the whole thing is just embarrassing at times.
Mnuchin has said the cuts would pay for themselves under the dynamic scoring model, which takes into account the effect of tax changes on economic growth and revenue. Still, they're not describing how economic growth is going to happen.
Well, this is the idea behind Reagan. The Reagan administration, they had a tax cut, and they calculated that the the proposed tax cut would actually cause so much increase in business that the government would get more revenue. Even though the taxes were reduced, there would be so much more business that they'd get a smaller percentage, but on a bigger piece of the pie, and the government would make more revenue. That was the argument. I've heard David Stockman say they thought they believed that at the time, but it didn't really work out that way.
No.
They didn't really get more money. So, I don't know. The whole thing is, it's a sales pitch.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's all it is.
He added that the plan would get rid of almost every single tax deduction, which he said was disproportionately used by wealthy, and that the aim was that 95% of Americans would no longer need to itemize deductions. Wasn't that great? Yesterday we talked about cuts in retirement accounts. Now you know why. It's going to pay in dropping the corporate tax rate from 35% to 15%, which most of your corporations don't even pay 35% because of all the loopholes. So who really gets, you know, so who's
really
going to...
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We're going to cut the tax rate, but we're also going to cut all the loopholes.
Yeah.
And by the time we're done, are you going to pay more taxes or less taxes? What do you need more? A lower tax rate or more loopholes? Which is, maybe the government could come in and say, look, we're not going to raise tax rates, we're not going to lower them, but we're going to give you more loopholes. How about that, Melody?
More loopholes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. More loopholes. Loopholes for everyone.
Since we've seen, and I don't mean with the new administration, but I mean Washington has pretty much been a circus for a very long time now. The Ringling Brothers Circus closes on Sunday after 146
really?
Years. Yeah. Sunday will mark the last time the Ringling Brothers Circus will send in the clowns. Just go to Washington. You can see all the clowns you want.
Yeah, right.
After 146 years of entertaining audiences with clowns and animal acts, the greatest show on earth will host its last and final performance on Sunday when one of its two traveling circuses will perform its final show in New York. The other closed this month in Providence, Rhode Island, and with it, the end to a way of life few others have experienced. The Associated Press was allowed to observe it extensively. And it's really just a kind of a neat little, you know, it's the article goes on and talks about how an elephant stretches its trunk through a window to soothe a sick child. A woman gives birth and 3 months later is back performing on the high wire. The big cats, the beasts are loping out into the ring for the one last time. And, you know, we talk about how things are changing so much, how we're seeing a change in, you know, with retail and... and this is just kind of 146 years. That's a long, long time.
Long time to last. I went to Ringling Brothers Barnley and Bailey circuses back when I was a kid, and I really enjoyed them. I look back. I'm sorry to see that they're going. All right, we're going to take a break, couple of commercials, be back on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
I told you.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. We've got new music, bumper music on here. I didn't know whether I should actually start talking.
I think
or
it's the same song, just a little
keep
bit further.
Same
song, just a little further in.
Is it?
I think.
No, I haven't heard it before.
Roger Ailes, he was the guy at Fox News. He's passed on today. And I don't know what he died from.
77.
Well, that doesn't mean, I mean, yes, he is 77, but I didn't see that he had any health problems or anything like that.
He was thrown out of that job about a year ago over sexual harassment allegations.
I don't even think it was a year ago. I think it was this past fall. It was during the campaign. But yeah, you're right. He was thrown out.
The loss of his job may have just destroyed his will to live. And a lot of people can't really make it and retired. They can't retire. They've got to work. Once you take away the work, it used to be a profound symptom or characteristic of the American people. Back when I was a kid, it was you only lived 2 or 3 years after you retired, and then you're gone. Today, people are more adjusted to it. They're looking forward to retirement, and it doesn't bother a lot of people, but I would imagine that Ailes probably was a very hard charger. And to be removed from his position of power and work and authority,
well, may have put him very heavy. That's all fine and dandy, but it was 10 months since he'd been forced out as chairman of Fox News Channel. There was rumors of a breakdown in his marriage and pending divorce. He was shamed. I mean, he didn't have, when you're kicked out of your job because of sexual harassment, and there's a lot of shame to that. It's almost the same thing. We don't know how he passed on, whether he just gave up living. He might have even taken his own life. We don't know, and I'm not saying he did. But I saw the same thing in State College when Joe Paterno, got caught up in the, I can't think of the guy's name, the sex case up there with little boys, the pedophile. And he died shortly thereafter. He did have problems. He did have cancer, though, so there was an underlying problem.
Yeah, but did he but have he it? Died. Did he know he had cancer before that problem showed up?
He was shamed. It was right before that, if I remember correctly, it was right before that all broke loose. He was still coaching the team and everything. So, but shortly thereafter, he just kind of withered up. And he did lose his will. But he was shamed. If the allegations are true, what has happened at Fox and so forth, it's not the only place in this country that happens to. You can come to your own. And I don't know if they'll. I mean, look what they did to Bill O'Reilly. He's history at Fox and so forth. And that doesn't make you a very nice person to do those things. So,
yeah, he's rolling in dollars. I mean, there's compensations, I guess. I don't know if that's true or false, but it is something where your legacy and for your family and the image you leave behind is all of a sudden tarnished. Bill Cosby comes to mind.
Yeah.
and it's we live at an age again where things, there's no secrets.
No.
And if someone wants to dig deep enough into almost anyone's background, except for yours and mine, of course, Melody, but if anyone wants to dig into other people's backgrounds deep enough, you can find things that are probably going to be a little embarrassing, maybe a lot embarrassing. And there's, you know, the things that could have been hidden and concealed and forgotten. Not so in the internet age. Here's an article from the Huffington Post that kind of goes along with this idea, and it's and the headline is "Art of the Deal" co-author. He said Trump will resign, then declare victory. The man who co-authored "Art of the Deal" with Donald Trump, a book often cited on the campaign trail last year, said the president will soon look for a way out of all his administration scandals. Co-author of The Art of the Deal on Trump, he said, I think he is in a pretty significant meltdown. And we talked a little about this the other day. The idea that Trump is used to giving orders and everybody jumps. And now he gives orders and everybody just kind of, I don't know. There's a problem here. And the guy, this Tony Schwartz, he was the co-author of The Art of the Deal. He was actually the ghost author. Trump took credit for writing the book, but... Tony Schwartz apparently wrote the vast majority of it based on his interviews with Trump. He says there is no right or wrong for Trump. There's only winning and losing. Right now, he is in pure terror that he is going to lose. I think he's reacting from a survival place. I think he's being run by part of his brain that's reactive and impulsive, not capable of reflection, and I think he's in a pure defensive mode. Evidence of his meltdown is in the fact that he's starting to scream at Jared Kushner. Schwartz predicted that Trump would ultimately lose, but said he won't go through the impeachment process. I surely believe that at some point over the next period of time, he's going to have to figure out a way to resign. But in quitting, Trump will try to figure out a way, as he's done all his career, to turn a loss into a victory, so he will declare victory when he leaves. And what that reminds me of, I mean, all of this, I don't know that any of this is true beyond my belief that this guy Tony Schwartz actually made these comments. The source on this is the Huffington Post. It should be reliable. It should be accurate, you know, record of what Tony Schwartz has said on this. But when he says Trump is going to try to turn this into a victory, he's going to resign. Well, this reminds me of peace with honor in Vietnam. This reminds me of Richard Nixon resigning from the White House and claiming he was doing it for the country or whatever. I mean, if Trump actually, if this was actually true, and I am very skeptical, but if it were true that Trump would resign and then try to spin it to make it look like a victory, I don't think anybody would buy it. I think it's one of the reasons why I don't think that Trump is going to resign. I don't think it's going to happen. I would be very much surprised. I'm not saying he wouldn't like to get out of the job. Maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't. I don't know. But I don't think he can resign without tarnishing the Trump brand. Right?
I think his brand is already tarnished, Al.
Well, I don't know. It depends. In some people's minds, it is. But it depends on whether you admit it or not. If you make admissions, it's one thing for people to sit back and say, so-and-so is a crook. All right. Uh-huh. Well, all right. You get a certain adverse publicity. That's not good for you. But as long as they spell your name right, maybe it's not so bad. Yeah, but if you come out and say, yeah, actually, I am a crook, now you got a problem. Now you have a problem, and you can kiss your legacy goodbye. And if this goes to court or whatever, this guy Schwartz, he says, I remember vividly when I was working with Trump how terrified people would be of going up against him in any way. When you can sense that he was feeling, I can guarantee you he is feeling right now. When you can sense what he was feeling, I guarantee he is feeling right now. That's not exactly a clear sentence, but he does imply that Trump may not have been a perfect angel to work for. Now, is that true? Or is this just Tony Schwartz trying to, you know, get even for some slight involved in writing that book?
Well, I saw an article by, you know, I'm not going to psychoanalyze Trump, but, you know, he when he was campaigning, the same guy, there was a lengthy article in the Times where he wrote that Trump is nothing of the man that is projected in the book, The Art of the Deal. Tony Schwartz says, I made that guy. He says, I wrote that guy. I created that man. He says Trump didn't have anything to do with the book. Trump wanted a book written for him, by him, and he wanted to be portrayed as this successful negotiator.
Yep.
And Tony Schwartz said, I created the guy. There is no such person. So I'm not sure where, and I know after that article was written, I know Schwartz and Trump, you know, certainly went head to head. Schwartz said he barely made any money off of the book. Trump said he made tons of money off the book. So, you know, it's, and they've known, and they knew each other for quite a while.
This goes back 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, they knew each other for, I mean, even prior to, so, and it's an interesting read about how they got connected and so forth. So I'm not sure where this guy's coming from, but you would think that he would have a, you know, because he basically had to live with Trump for a little bit to you know, get something to write about. But,
you know, anyway. It is kind of a, you look, if you're going to hang around, if I mean, he apparently is, he is at least implying that Trump is a pretty bad guy to work with. All right, didn't, maybe he didn't say that exactly, but he comes close. All right, then why did you work with him? You're a grown man. You didn't, nobody trapped you. I mean, apparently you might be a bad guy to work with, but
money,
on the
money,
other
money,
hand, the
money,
pay
money,
is pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the pay is pretty good. I don't know what the truth of the matter is, but it's a little bit flaky to come up 30 years after the book was written, or 20, however many it was, and now say, oh, there's a problem.
Well,
it's hard for people to trust that.
Yeah.
You know, just telling the truth here. But it is, it's not inconceivable that he's telling the truth. It may be that Trump, again, just if he, you know, the idea that Trump had someone else write most of, all or most of, The Art of the Deal, and then Trump took credit for writing that book, that's evidence that Trump is willing to deceive. That's an act of dishonesty. Look, if I'm going to write a book, an article, or whatever it is, and I put my name on it, that's fine. If it's stupid, it's stupid. All right? If it's insightful, it's insightful. I get the credit, I get the blame, because I actually wrote it. If I pay someone else to write articles on my behalf, all right, so I can take credit for them, it's almost certain that the day is going to come when people are going to look at those articles and think, boy, that guy Adask is really smart. And when they actually sit down and start talking to me, they realize, he's a dummy. He didn't have brains enough to write that book. He must have hired some ghostwriter. And that's interesting to me, just from a, that's interesting to me just from a moral perspective. Again, you can't get away with much. Right? In this internet age, who would have imagined that The Art of the Deal, which helped to make Trump, put him in a position where he could run for president, who would have imagined that it could also put him in a position where his presidency might be threatened? Truth comes out. How great, how wonderful, how astonishing, how frightening. Oh my gosh, the truth can come out, Melody. Everybody in favor of having the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth come out, raise your hands.
I don't want people to think that we're trashing Trump and, you know, so forth.
I'm not trashing him. Spade is spade.
It is, and that's what we do here. And it can go either way on anyone. So that's refreshing.
You know, I mean, Trump, he has more trouble coming at him than probably any president in my lifetime. He steps into the office, and it's almost like the Secret Service is shooting at him when he walks down the hall. This is, and he gets blamed for everything. We've talked about that in the past. You know, just, oh my gosh, Trump a bowl of Cheerios for breakfast today, and the newspapers and the leftists is, oh my gosh, the world is coming to an end. And that's nothing, well, though. Today he had Rice Chex, not Cheerios. It's even worse, Melody. It's worse than we thought. Somewhere along the line, Trump ought to get a break, but he doesn't get one. And the question is this whole thing just a witch hunt being conducted by the left against Trump that is largely without reason? Or does Trump have the kind of personality that alienates people in the White House? You know, he's not the boss in the sense he's the boss of Trump Towers. He owns Trump Towers. But he's just the head manager at the White House. I wonder if he's equipped to deal with that change in authority.
Well, it's probably everything, you know. But you know what? If you get to that position and you campaign and you know, I mean, my gosh, you're going through all kinds of security and you're getting briefings and everything even before the election and so forth. If you can't stomach it, if you can't grow some and be a man and do what needs to be done, you know what? This country is raised a bunch of wimps anymore. Everybody's trying to find an excuse for people for what they're doing wrong. And it's like, no, if you do something wrong, well, then just fix it. You don't need excuses. You don't need to be, all these different reasons why things happen and so forth. It's just like, God, grow up, deal with it, and move on.
You know, one of the things I think Trump may have done wrong.
What?
From a political perspective.
Oh, no, I'm ready to move on, Al, but go ahead.
We got from a political perspective, one of the things I think he may have done wrong is that since he's gotten to Washington and actually walked into the White House, I think he's kind of ignored the populists who got him elected in the first place. I think everyone has the impression that he's more interested in working with the people at Goldman Sachs and appointing them to positions of power. And I don't see that he's appointing any populists to serve in positions of power. And he's kind of abandoned his base, and now, as if he was going to, you know, play footsie with the elite, the establishment. Now the establishment seems to have lured him into a situation. I don't know. Does he still have any allies right now? Does he have any allies left right now?
Whenever he thinks he's losing his base, what does he do? He goes out and has a pep rally. He goes and cheers everybody up, and everybody falls right along with it. And, you know? It's like a football game. That's how he won the election.
It's more like Barnum and Bailey. Maybe that's why Barnum and Bailey is closing down. It's because the Congress and the government is opening up. Let's take a break for a couple of commercials. Melody and I will be right back on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two Black Berkey Elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. I'm here with Melody Cederstrom. What's next, Melody?
Cisco said yesterday that it's going to cut an additional 1,100 employees as part of an expanded and restructuring plan. The cuts come on top of the 5,500 jobs cuts, or 7% of its workforce, announced in August of 2016. And, of course, they're a technology company. Cisco says it plans to recognize hundreds of millions of pre-tax charges related to the restructuring. There it is, Al, restructuring, which will end around the first quarter of the 2018 fiscal year. And they actually reported better than expected earnings for the fiscal third quarter, but worse than feared forward guidance. Shares fell more than 5% after hours. Cisco said it expects revenues to fall another 4% to 6% year-over-year in the fourth quarter, with earnings of 60 cents to 62 cents per share adjusted. So they're not doing so hot. American Eagle Outfitters, they plan to accelerate its stores closing as it navigates what continues to be a challenging environment for apparel retailers. It's a Pittsburgh, PA-based company, American Eagle Outfitters. They shuttered three stores. And this is, and look at this. They opened three stores. They shuttered three stores and opened six in the first quarter, an estimated between 25 and 40 store closings for the fiscal year ending in April 2018. With between
Well, they're going to close 45. How many do they expect to open? If they open six and they close three, are they going to open any? Or is it?
Yeah, they're gonna, let me finish. 32 to 37 store openings across its various brands. So, but
I give them credit. They're managing their business. Yeah, they appear to be managing their business.
Yeah, they're relocating to see if it helps. Federal Reserve Bank of New York, they released its household debt and credit report for the first quarter of 2017. And with all the speak of the economy recovering, and while things feel better on the business front, household debt has now reached an all-time high. Gains in mortgage debt, auto debt, student debt were all cited. This all-time high now stands at $12.73 trillion and was $149 billion higher than in the fourth quarter of 2016. What stands out here is that it is about $50 billion above the previous peak that was reached back in the third quarter of 2008, right before the recession kicked into overdrive. So, again, parallels what happened before. And there's some interesting notes here. They show that the aggregate delinquency rates were roughly flat in the first quarter of this year. Some 4.8% of outstanding debt was listed as being in some stage of delinquency. Of that total, $615 billion of debt listed as is delinquent. Some $426 billion is listed as seriously delinquent and at least 90 days late or severely derogatory. Debt balance has climbed in several areas. Mortgage debt rose 1.7%. Car loans were up 0.9%, and student loans were up 2.6%.
Well, we harp on it all the time, and I know that some people get tired of hearing about it, but this debt is the big story. Sooner or later, we're going to deal with this in a way where people are going to have to understand that when they say restructuring, that we're going to restructure the debt. What's that mean? We're going to get the creditors to agree to take a haircut, in other words, suffer a loss. It's a repudiation of debt. That's what restructuring is. It's I borrow $100,000 from somebody, and I say, well, we need to restructure the debt because I can only pay back maybe $50,000. And if the And if the creditor doesn't go along with my restructuring proposal, then he gets nothing. Right? He doesn't get the $100,000 because I'm broke. I can't pay the $100,000. He doesn't even get the $50,000, which I might be able to pay. But what restructuring is, it's a polite term for describing your condition of insolvency, bankruptcy. You have repudiated existing debt. Right? This isn't a restructuring. They make it sound like it's something civilized. What it is they just walk up to the creditor and say, look, here's the deal. You either take a big cut on how much we owe you, or you don't get anything. And the ultimate deal is it's better, you know, better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick. Right? Take the deal. Better to get $50,000. Okay, you can't get the 100, which you expected, but take the 50. Right? But you're losing $50,000 because of this restructuring. So, I don't know. The system, they try to decorate it, and they try to make it sound like everything is still working, but the truth is we have more restructuring. I don't know that it's enough to say that the economy is in great peril, but we're having more restructuring now, not just in this country, but in Greece, for example, and other debtors. Everybody, a lot of people, a lot of entities are trying to restructure their debt. And that's just a code word to avoid admitting that they're bankrupt. You can't pay, right? You can't pay your bills. You are technically bankrupt. You say, oh, no, I'm not bankrupt. I'm just restructuring. See, Melody, was just restructuring.
Restructuring, right? Yeah.
It's a little like by saying, I'd rather owe it to you than cheat you out of it. But you're not going to get it right now. Yeah. It's restructuring, Melody. So, you know, there shouldn't even be a term like restructuring. I know there can be. I can understand that actually it makes sense even from the creditor's perspective, because sometimes the debtor really does, they go broke. Why get beat out of the whole $100,000 if you can reach a deal where the debtor actually pays you 50? Right? Better to get 50 than lose 100,000. It's not just a situation for the debtors, it's a situation, it's a strategy that can help the creditors too. But it is being used in a way where it's not the creditor who comes up and says, look, let's renegotiate this, and I'll tell you what, if you can give me 50,000, we'll forget the 100,000 that you owe. What do you say? All right, then when you don't get a bankruptcy on your record and the rest of that sort of thing. All right, at that point in time, if it's advanced by the creditor, they understand and appreciate that the debtor is going broke, that he's near bankruptcy or whatever. All right, I can kind of understand that, but it's being used by the debtors. They say, well, we need to restructure. You either take this deal or you lose the whole deal. You lose the whole 100,000. You either settle for 50 or lose the whole 100. What do you want to do? It's being abused, or at least that's the way it appears to me. And the solution should just be bankruptcy. Can't pay your bills, file for bankruptcy. Very simple. But nobody wants to do that, and probably they can't do it in our debt-based monetary system. I don't think we can admit the debt can't be paid. I think we're caught in circumstances, and Greece is, to me, the best evidence of this. Greece should have filed for bankruptcy 7 years ago.
We should have, too.
Oh, we should have, too. But under the debt-based monetary system, we have to maintain the debt. It must be maintained and kept and treasured as if it were an asset. And if somebody files for bankruptcy, it wipes out the asset. The debt is canceled. And that's our fundamental form of money, and we use it as collateral in banks. With fractional reserve banking, if I've got $1 million debt instrument in my bank vault, I can lend out $9 million to the public. If I cancel that $1 million debt, that's repudiated. I admit that this is no longer a performing loan. I have to call in $9 million that I'd loaned out to people in the community. I think this reversal on fractional reserve banking, I think the idea that you have to call in these debts, I think that's what's terrifying these people. Because
you'll
collapse the whole system if this thing goes badly, and the key to it is we must maintain the debt. Greece should have filed for bankruptcy, but if they did, they would have destroyed the value
Well,
so much debt, so many debt instruments, bonds, and whatever in Europe, that it might have been enough to do some real serious damage, not just to Greece, but to other countries.
Well, they, hundreds of thousands of Greeks, since you brought Greece up, Greeks walked off the job yesterday, or Wednesday, heeding the call of labor unions to join a 24-hour general strike to protest a new round of austerity measures. The effects of the strike, which came in response to pledges from the leftist-left government of Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras to Greece's international creditors, were widespread. Flights, public transportation were disrupted, ships remained anchored in ports, government offices were closed, hospitals operated with limited staff. So they had major... So they just walked off the job. And Greece, as we said, has been struggling for years. And their unemployment is now at 23%. Mm-hmm. The country is largely dependent on outside help. They had demonstrations were held in Athens and other major cities against the new round of belt tightening, which calls for pension cuts. Did you hear that, folks? Pension cuts starting in 2019 and tax increases beginning in 2020. They cut your money and then they increase your taxes.
Mm-hmm. It's called austerity.
It's called austerity.
Right.
They don't care about you. Man.
And it means that the people have to pay the government's debt. That's what it means. So we're gonna put the screws to the people. We're gonna call it austerity, so you can preserve the debt and keep it functional, and we can maintain the illusion that these worthless pieces of paper actually have some value.
And even here you have the Tsipras. He campaigned. We're going to break away from those international creditors, and we're going to do it my way and blah, 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 and see where it got him. You know,
Well, that's the problem. See, I don't think I don't think very many people really understand the way the monetary system works, and particularly the way the debt-based monetary system works. I don't think they get it. They think of these green pieces of paper as if they were assets, the Federal Reserve notes in your wallet. They're not. They're liabilities. They're debt instruments. They're not assets. You're not getting paid when you receive a piece of paper. You get paid when you get something tangible in your hand. Could be a house, could be a car, could be a gun, could be bullets, could be food, could be pieces of gold or silver. Because something tangible you've been paid, as long as you're taking a piece of paper, you are taking a promise to pay in a world where the promises can't all be kept. And sooner or later, most of them, in my opinion, are going to be repudiated. I'd say 80-90%, but for sure 50%. To my mind, I can't imagine how they could pay 50% of the debt. Right? I can't imagine how they could, but I'll concede it's possible, but I can't get it myself. I'm guessing 80 to 90% of the debt will be repudiated. And that means, again, 80 to 90% of the people who are holding paper debt instruments as a form of wealth are going to lose their assets. All right? They're going to be in trouble. And it'll be trouble for everybody. There isn't any sweet ride around here. But those who have preserved their wealth in something tangible, like gold, like silver, they will have the best opportunity to survive and get through what may be extremely difficult circumstances. But I just don't trust paper as far as I can throw it. Or digital is the same thing. Digital currency, another one. Oh boy, Bitcoin and the rest of that sort of thing. All sounds like it's an intriguing idea. Right? And no doubt, you know, a world changing, revolutionary, but it's still, it's not a payment. It's ultimately a promise to pay. And that's what you get from the Federal Reserve, and that's what you get from the government right now. And sooner or later, it's got to blow up in everybody's face. Got an article here from MarketWatch, and the headline is, Why Dollar Bulls Are Thinking About Shifting Their Outlook. I say the bullish outlook for the U.S. dollar at the beginning of the year made some sense at the time, but analysts are shifting their views after recent weakness that took the greenback to its lowest levels in 6 months. In other words, we're losing some confidence in the dollar. Now, this isn't news, and it's the sort of thing we talk about on a fairly regular basis on this program, but what's interesting to me is the headline came from MarketWatch, which is a No, but well-respected outlet for news concerning the markets. All right, they're saying dollar bulls are thinking about shifting their outlook. They are telling us that they think the value of the dollar is going to go down. We're going to see more inflation. Dollar is going to go down, and they're telling us by implication, the gold is going to go up. Here's another one from The Street, which is another respected publication. And it says, enjoy the gold rally. It's just getting started. That's the headline. The article itself didn't have any news, at least not for people who listen to this program. But what was impressive to me is this is a credible mainstream publication. And they say, enjoy the gold rally. It's just getting started. That signals something to me. It's telling me that there are people in the system right now that are beginning to see this thing's gold is going to be a good deal in the near future. And they're saying, you know, maybe it's time to take a look. So we're out of time. Want to thank everyone for listening. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. We hope you have a good afternoon, a good evening. And in the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Todd, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay.
Ain't it sad?
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.